Just here. All right, welcome to another episode of Fucan Conversation. So excited to have my good friend and colleague Aparna Mishra Tark here with us from York University. Aparna, welcome to the show. What's your new book called?
It's called Pedagogy in the Novels of J.M. Coetzee, The Affect of Literature. And hi, Nicholas. It's great to be here.
Hey, it's great to be here with you as well. So, look, the premise of the podcast, at least the first few that I've done, have been to reach out colleagues and friends to send me two or three pieces of their work, and I read through them and then ask you a few questions about that work, but really hoping quite selfishly to use your work or draw on your work in a new course that I'm teaching this spring, summer. And so I'm really excited to have a conversation with you about that work, and hopefully it'll add a behind-the-scenes context to how you approach your work so students can get a better sense of the author behind the words. And I know, you know, in terms of your own work that you've been doing and looking, for example, in your most recent book, the relationship between pedagogy and the novel. And also thinking about pedagogy being, as you called it, one of the central characters in subject formation. And then what I've really enjoyed about reading your intro to that book is the deep interconnections in terms of your own psychical life to literature. And then also the figure of the teacher in the different chapters that you take up in that book. So I was just wondering if you could speak a little bit about your relationship to pedagogy and then how you're conceptualizing the figure of the teacher during these, especially during these times of COVID-19 and what teachers are being asked to do, including yourself.
Yes, thanks for that question. I think I consider myself first and foremost a curriculum scholar. And so what I mean by that is that I want to investigate the relationship between knowledge, the way that it's delivered to a person, which is what I call pedagogy, and the way that the kind of person one becomes. And I try to think of it in two ways. I try to think of it personally through the intimate and the autobiographical, but also through the world or through structure or through the system or through the dominant discourse. So those two things, I mean, I think Ted Aoki talked about the planned curriculum and the existential and the lived curriculum. And in a way, I'm grappling with those two things all the time in my work. And literature is the medium by which I can understand aspects of pedagogy that aren't empirical, that are non-evident, that you feel and you know. That you feel that knowledge has affected you this way, or a novel's affected you this way, or a science problem has affected you this way, but you have no way to prove it. And so literature helps me, you know, think about what knowledge does to us. And the other thing that I'm really interested in is the question of what kind of education, how does education make a person, I guess, is the question. And I like Coetzee's work a lot because I think that he is also, that question also plagues him through the novels, is that if we had a different kind of education, and for an example for him, if he didn't grow up during the apartheid era, what kind of person could have he been? And he kind of resents history in a way. He resents that he's had that he was raised in such brutal times, and he's a sensitive person, and it's a different way of thinking about history in a way. Like, it's when we think about residential history here in Canada, if we bring it to Canadian history, we always think it's like something that we have to repair, something we have to fix, rather than something that happened to us, and that's terrible, and happened to different people differently, and of course devastatingly for Indigenous communities, but it happened, and it's made us into certain kinds of people, and that's what we have to reckon with. We can't do anything about history in a way, but we can reckon with the kinds of people that we've become. So And I think education is the way to also intervene. And I think Justice Sinclair said that education got us into this mess and it will get us out of it. And I think that I hold tightly to that sentiment as well.
I mean, and I think, you know, one of the things that you refer to in your work is in many ways reflecting on, and the example you provided, his own childhood during an apartheid era and how one could be different if there was a different historical context in relation to the individual as a child. And I think that's something that I've found in your work that you trouble is the conceptualization of the child as being ahistorical or the child somewhere as our hope in the future. And I'm just wondering how, when you're thinking about education in relation to the formation of the subject or the potential ways in which education or the kinds of education that, that shape us in terms of who we are, how are you thinking about that in relation specifically to pedagogy? And then also your work with psychoanalysis. So I know in much of your work, you're looking at whether it's Melanie Klein or Julia Kristeva, mothers become a central figure in terms of the relationship of self and other and how we relate to our own psychic life of the child or how we might imagine the child and how that child plays out as a figure within the literature that you take up. How, you know, in terms of all of that work and the works that you provided, how are you thinking about the way in which we're situating the concept of a child during these current during the current context of the COVID-19 pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a really, really important question, and I actually haven't thought about it in the way that you've phrased it. So I thank you for that because that will spur on some more thinking for me. I actually hadn't thought about how central all of that is to my thinking, is what I mean, and I think that what psychoanalysis has given me is a little bit of what literature gives me. It's a way to find a vocabulary or language for the aspects of a pedagogical formation that are unspeakable, but you know are happening to you. You know you're becoming, for instance, you know, for me, my childhood is, I think a lot about the effect of whiteness on my childhood and on my parents, on myself as a child of an immigrant, and the ways in which I've internalized that. And say if they didn't come to Canada to my parents, what kind of person would I have been, right? If I had been subject to a different kind of cultural pedagogy or a different kind of upbringing, you know, South Asians raise children very differently than they do than Canadians and British people. And so, all of that is, I think all of that features in my understanding of the child and the mother, the self and the other, the student and the teacher. All of those relationships have the same kind of familial dynamic. And so psychoanalysis helps me think of the familial dynamic as it plays out in different relationships. And, you know, there's a concept called of transference where your past experiences intrude on your present. And I think that in learning, that happens all the time. The child's at school, they're learning something, and then all of a sudden they fall back into a memory of something that happened at home or and that is that layered kind of psychical dynamic is at play all the time in learning, and we don't speak about it. I mean, the other thing I think that's really key to pedagogy is attachment and to learning too, that one has to attach to the material. And usually they have to attach to the person delivering or the object delivering the knowledge. So in the case of young children, they attach to the teacher in order to take in the knowledge. There's just no other way of doing it. And in the case of a learner learning from a book or from, from a proof, they also attach to whatever knowledge you're engaging with in order to be able to reckon with it. And so I think about in COVID-19, how we're doing so much online teaching. And, my daughter told me a funny story that the kids have gone on the Google Classroom and they've given it bad ratings because if you don't get at least 2 out of 5, they take the app away. The app has failed and they don't use it anymore or something like that. So the kids have got this idea that if they fail the app, they won't have to do Google Classroom anymore. And so despite all of the corporations and the university wanting to move to online learning, I think there's something fundamental about pedagogy and the relationship between self and other, or self and mother. The first other is just the mother, and that it's not that the mother is some special thing, but your first other is your mother, or the parent who is, you know, the significant parent. I do not think that learning can take place without the other, the other's voice, the other's affirmation, the other's recognition, and there's a way that the kids feel that. They feel that they need other people in order to learn. And so I think that's what we'll learn after COVID-19 is how important that relationship is and how central it is to driving knowledge. So this is where I think I intervene in the curricular understanding as running the course, as knowledge running the course of your life. The career notion is that it's not, for me, it's not just that knowledge, you know, holds our life. It's not that just knowledge runs our lives, or that we engage in similar texts throughout our life, or similar contents search us out for all our life. It's that it actually holds our life as well. You know, I think of it not of the running part. I think about the chariot that holds the runner, you know, or the racer, as being the vessel and as being the pedagogical kind of vessel. So whoever it is, the teacher, the mother, the supervisor, you know, if you're a doctoral student, holding the knowledge is critical for the student's capacity to learn it, I think it was maybe Lacan who said that the role of the teacher is really to support the student to find what's in them, what's within them, you know, what's been lost because of education and what might be refound, but what's always been in them. The role of the teacher is not to impose their knowledge on a student, but actually to unearth the knowledge that the student has within. So
I was just going to say, just a follow-up question to that, because on the one hand, you're saying that it's in terms of thinking about psychoanalysis and students really having this relationship of transference to a teacher, and that pedagogy becomes the vessel for carrying the knowledge. And I just, in your recent book, you speak to Coetzee, how Coetzee characterizes, and this is what you say, immeasurable qualities of memory, desire, silence, care, language, violence, relation, as key to the internal operations of pedagogy. And in his characters, Coetzee depicts pedagogy as an interior problem where one's desires for knowing clash with those of others. And in this seductive sense, pedagogy is already invested in making its subject. And so I on the one hand, there's knowledge and one's and pedagogy in terms of being the vessel. And I'm just wondering, I mean, it seems to me a lot of your work takes up the concept of psychical violence in different forms, whether that's through reparation or even just the example that you gave of a student sitting in a classroom and thinking back to an experience at home or somewhere else and having to navigate one's attention or to attend to one's lived experiences when it's intention to, you know, whether you're daydreaming or thinking about something else at home, and then being called to pay attention to something at school that necessarily might not necessarily be invested in terms of your relationship to it. And so again, the other example you gave was your kids trying to rate the Google Classroom with a 2 because their relationship or investment to that at this current moment in COVID-19, it's probably not the most important thing in terms of their investment. So I'm just wondering if you, the concept of relation, the relations in terms of the way in which you're thinking about literature and pedagogy, whether that's from a psychoanalytical perspective or even just literary theory and the ways in which you take up your works. I just wonder if you could hear a little bit more about your take on that.
Yeah. I really think that for my work, that I really do think that I privilege the personal, the interior, the autobiographical in ways that I think education fails to do. So I think in schools that we as teachers often, and I mean, I think this will change now after COVID actually, because there's so many parents and teachers and children in conversation with each other online right now. But there's a way in which the familial life of the child is cut off at the door, and there's a new world, you know, the public world or the private public world, the domestic public world, I would say, of school takes over, and there's a new community, and the child's identity is reformed in school as a different person than they are at home. And I think my work really resists that and tries to use both psychoanalysis and fiction to think about what it would mean for us to really value a person in school. And so that's one thing. The other thing that I really hold on to is Kristeva's notion of revolt. So meaning that no matter what kind of social forces, whether it be education, whether it be oppressive, like war, whatever social conditions, or COVID, for instance, whatever social conditions a child is faced with, something within resists and revolts, being formed into something that the child does not want to be, right? And so I really hold to Kristeva's notion of revolt. I mean, I remember Shoshana Feldman said that nothing can truly be learned without a crisis. I think also nothing can truly be learned without revolt. So without someone resisting the knowledge that's being imposed on them that doesn't feel right or that doesn't feel like them, between, it's kind of a, you know, like the dialectic between learning and not learning is learning, knowledge is produced. So between learning and not learning, knowledge is produced. And so that's what I'm really interested in. I think that's where psychoanalysis can help me with a vocabulary. The other thing is, yes, the object relations theory is really important to my understanding of learning, because, again, in order for the learner to be able to know anything, they have to be able to take in the object, digest it. You know, this would be the real primal kind of language that Klein uses. You know, digest it, spit it back out into the world, and the knowledge is sort of changed by the ways in which the person integrates it. So you and I could read the same article, Nick, and just like we're doing now in the podcast, we're trying to find a way to reconcile our understandings of different kinds of ideas, but they're marked by our difference, mine by mine, yours by yours, and somewhere in our communication of those ideas, we find moments of agreement, but also moments of tension. And that's so important. That's the important work of learning, I think. And that's why I think there is that I do resist online learning in a way, because I feel this deliberative, studious, attentive, free inquiry that the university has always modeled, or at least modeled until when I was a doctoral student. I think today we're in some other kind of mode of learning in the university sometimes. But that old way of learning, you know, that the Greeks called padia, that sustains your life. It brings meaning to you. It brings significance to you. And you see young children studying grass and studying bugs or studying the way that birds fly in the sky. That we ought to really pay attention, close attention to that, because the way that children engage with objects, and I think this is what Klein was saying, can give us a lot of insight into how it is that we become adults and the things that we forget about learning when we're adults, about its disappointments, its wonder, the resentments we might hold, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, I find that fascinating. It's almost what you're saying is that we're always, even during the podcast, coming together as two strangers in a negotiation of meaning in terms of the different ways in which we approach literature, whether that's me reading your work or asking you to reread your work with me today during the podcast. And I wonder in that sense, then, is there always a potential of a certain amount of psychic violence that takes place when one is unable to understand the other or fully comprehend with the other? And there seems to me in the context of schooling that there's an expectation from the teacher in terms of the story of education that students need to come to some sort of understanding of what the teacher is trying to teach, and that there's less room or flexibility for negotiation or revolt around the actual meaning of the object that's being negotiated in such understanding. And I wanted to come back to your piece on reparation, because in it you say processes of cycle reparation test and build upon our internal capacity to withstand the possibility of being broken by knowledge of the other's existence. And so in a sense, repairing psychical violence within readies the self to manage ordinary and extreme forms of social violence. But so, and saying that, and of course you're looking at reparation in relation to the larger legal and ethical context, but then in this piece, you're calling on others to try to understand the psychical expressions of reparation without any promise. I'm just wondering, in terms of your work with pedagogy and literature, do you see reparation as something that's an ongoing process of one coming to the school curriculum or the relationship between the teacher and student? So to me, that kind of hit me after what you just shared.
Well, also too, I didn't quite respond to your question around psychical violence, I realize. So I kind of avoided that for some reason, but it is key. Psychical violence is key to the process of learning, the way I think about it. I mean, we suffer egoistic, you know, an injury to the ego when we're confronted with a knowledge that doesn't align with how we think. So, and the problem with thinking about psychical violence is it's not equivalent to social violence. And this is what I was trying to say, although they have something to say to each other. But this is what I was trying to get across in the reparative curriculum piece, is that if we don't attend to the ways in which the inner life of communities like Indigenous people and other communities have been completely erased or diminished or demeaned by social history, then it's an inadequate measure, I think, to just offer up words or monetary reparations or even infrastructure for communities without also attending to the relational violence between settler and Indigenous communities that is unsaid, unspoken, and yet circulating through everything that we do and making it possible for us to play out over and over the colonial violence in everyday life. And you know, we see the scenes of it still in different form. It's not in the form of residential schools, but it's in the form of pipelines. It's in the form of, discounting. Right now, I mean, I've not heard much about what's going on in Indigenous communities regarding the COVID. All of these things are playing out the colonial relationship over and over again. And so my view, and I think it's the view of people who work in memory studies and trauma studies, is that without you can't actually, you know, you can't actually heal trauma, but what you can do is work through it. You can find a language for it. You can make it recognizable. It can make an appeal to others. And so in order to do that, you have to find some way to express what happens to you or what happened to your community. And so I think of the psychical life as something that you can't actually name or story in the way that we tell the story of our life, but something that's traced in the story that we can discern. I mean, Derrida talks about violence as the force of law. He's talking about in social life, that violence is the force of law. It is the thing that instantiates structure. It's the thing that instantiates normativity. You can't get away from schooling being in imposing violence on psychical violence and then real violence on students. There's no way to get away from it. You are imposing your what you think knowledge is on others. That's the basic relationship, of the pedagogical relationship. You are leading the child in the world, whether they want to come into it or not. And because we give so little room to people's inner life, teachers don't know the ways in which that they injure students all the time, like even with a look or a passive comment and I don't know if there's any way of getting around it, you know, except for to be aware that that happens, and that you can choose as a teacher to disregard your students. You know, I've heard people say, well, the students' learning is their responsibility and the teacher's teaching is their responsibility. Well, I don't subscribe to that. I feel the teacher is in a position like a parent, and has a duty to think about and regard all of their students with care, and that that might not eliminate violence, but it can diminish the worst kinds. And I think as teachers and as human beings, we should always be working towards the lesser violence, as impossible as that project might be.
You know, we talk about students and the concept of learning and the teacher's conceptualization or a teacher's conceptualization of the concept of learning and how that is represented in the story of the classroom and what constitutes a child's symbolic representation of learning within the context of the classroom. And you take that up through Klein's work in your essay on reparation, but also I can see that in the way in which you are looking at the different representations of teacher across Coetzee's work. And what struck me, and I really wanted to ask this question yesterday, because I was trying to think it through, is to articulate or to try to create a space for students to express their feelings as a form of learning. And I think that's something that you really call our attention to and provoke us to think about. So whether it's in reparation, where you're thinking about, you know, how do we create the spaces, and maybe it's an impossibility of the teacher to be able to do, but to work to set up ways in which, whether that's a teacher in the classroom or you and teacher candidates or you and grad students, to afford others opportunities to symbolize, you know, feelings of pathos or what you refer to as pathetic feelings that can find a way for symbolic release. So in the reparation piece, that's, you know, you're looking at a sense of feeling pathetic and how does mm-hmm. one address that in relation to the larger questions of reparation, whether it's the macro context, like in relation to the intergenerational violence of Indian residential schooling system, and whether that's material or psychical. And then in your new book, you're looking at humiliation. And so forms in which we can express or symbolize humiliation. So I you know, how are you thinking about, and maybe you're not thinking about feelings of pathetic feelings and humiliation in terms of how we're dealing with COVID-19, and that could be in relation to teachers and students negotiating that, or even ourselves, like you and I as professors or politicians, whether that's, you know, Justin Trudeau or to whisper his name, Donald Trump. So I'm just wondering how you're thinking about those two, humiliation and pathetic feelings and our capacity to symbolize them, or if they are being symbolized, how are you interpreting them?
Well, I think that those are just examples. I mean, that those are my examples of my attempts to try to qualify the unbearableness of feeling, mostly bad feelings, you know, but love is unbearable as well. But the feeling love and hate, that is, you know, part of the condition of being a human that has to live amongst other humans that are not like you. You know, humiliation, pathos, all of these words that I use try to qualify love and hate beyond those, beyond its binary meaning that is just so reductive. And you know, the child says "I hate you" to the parent, and what they mean by that is not apparent. It's not that you say, "Oh, my child actually hates me." No, there's something. They're frustrated. they aren't getting what they want. The parent is the bully. Whatever it is, right? That they're responding to is not just simply cannot simply be scooped up by the word hate. And so, yeah, I try to use these other ways of thinking about the unbearability of feeling, the unbearableness of expressing feeling, but also hearing and receiving it if you're on the hearing and receiving end. You know, it's easy to talk about feelings, and I think a lot of affect theorists and others have tried to talk about feelings in this abstract and detached way. I don't think that's going to bring us any closer to feeling. I think what will bring us closer to feeling, if we are good qualifiers of it and that we try to attend to it, maybe in the way of an analyst, but also in the way of a teacher, I think. And so what I really want to try to get across, I think, from the work before and the work now is, how do we attend to feel the role of feeling in learning when sometimes we don't know what we're feeling? So and COVID's such a good example of, you know, there's this like overwhelming dread and anxiety that's sort of just like a gnaw ache that, you know, we're going along with trying to do our regular stuff, but in the back of our mind is this stress or this, you know, feeling of anxiety. And we're supposed to try to work anyways. And you can see that learning is really difficult during this time. Writing is difficult. Reading is difficult. Talking's not so difficult. Talking to each other like we are. It's helpful. It helps us. And so it's that kind of thing, I think, that I really am trying to get at when I'm trying to think through, you know, that's why I call the book The Affective Literature, is I'm not only thinking about the ways in which literature moves us to thinking, but I want to think about how feeling moves us to thinking. That's what I want to really think about, is how our feelings can move us to both destructive and constructive impulses, can move us both to thinking and being thoughtless. And, you know, I mean, Trump's a very good example of a thoughtless person and the danger of thought. You know, Arendt said that evil is banal, but I really feel like evil is unredeemable. There's something unredemptive. There's something unthoughtful about evil acts. You know, so I feel like if that feeling is not only important in education in terms of learning knowledge and you know, that very beautiful project, but I also think that feeling is critical to the ways in which human beings think about the world, the ways in which they think about animal life, the way they think about other beings that are not like them, that most of the social violence and the social troubles that we have in the world are because we do not take feeling seriously. We do not take irrationality seriously. We do not take this need, this greedy, all-encompassing need to consume, to advance, to progress, to do anything we can to be, you know, the number one at the expense of others. These are irrational feelings. And that what we do need is maybe a little bit more deliberation, consideration, debate, thinking. But we can't do the thinking without also reckoning with the things that are thoughtless. So, you know, when I'm speaking about supporting students with their pathetic feelings, it's only so that we can think about history. It's not because I want to celebrate feelings in of themselves and abstract it from the world in any way. It's because that feeling is the ground of thought. What gives us grief makes us think. And so I want to bring those two together in a way that is productive for teachers and also for thinkers, for writers, for artists. Any block we have is a block of feeling, I think. And whether it's a writing block or a learning block or a relationship block, it's because we haven't been able to get our feelings in check.
So how do you take that up with teacher candidates or grad students in the courses that you teach? I'm not sure if you, do you have them read this piece or?
Well, I actually, you know what I actually do? I don't do a lot of my own, I don't teach a lot of my own work. But how I would look at it is probably in three different ways. I would use theory or, philosophy or theory or ideas texts, maybe I call them ideas texts. I would have support students to read texts that think through the problem of affect or think through the problem of the irrational or try to describe it. You know, I really like Lyotard's work, for example, and in texts like Heidegger and his Jews and his psychoanalytic work, where he really tries to image what it is that's unthinkable about human being and how affect works. He calls it unspeakable. So I would use some thinkers. That's one way I approach it. The other way I approach it is through autobiographical writing, and I strongly feel that all students, especially in their masters, should be engaged in autobiographical writing. You know, memories of their childhood, memories of learning, memories of something that was hard, that was a conflict. And the reason why I feel that autobiographical writing is really important in thinking is that it helps us sort of locate what it is that we really want to think about, what objects have always sort of chased us. And in my latest book, I talk about Coetzee and how when he was, I talk about this in the conclusion of the book, but when he was a child, he got this encyclopedia, and one of the stories in it was Robinson Crusoe. And he has written and revised and written and revised that story many, many times throughout his work, or a version of it. And this is an object that has captured him from childhood and that he has pursued all through his life. And that all of us have that. We just have to know what it is. And in order to know what it is, something, or in order to locate it, I mean, I don't know if we can know anything really, but in order to locate it, we need to think back. We need to think back through our life a little bit. And so, you know, whether, you know, students say, well, they come to me and they say, well, I really want to examine how racialized communities during COVID are affected by illness and the inequalities in care, et cetera, et cetera. Well, there's something I would suspect, that there's something in that student's history that's leading them to this question. Not always. Sometimes we want to pursue objects that have nothing to do with our history because we're sick of ourselves, and that's great too. But a lot of the times it starts with the self. And so autobiographical writing is the second way. And the very third way is to try to find a vocabulary, try to qualify the different kinds of feelings that overwhelm you or overwhelm the learner when they're learning. So I've done some work where I've observed children and observed the way their expressions, their behavior, the way that they try to express the things that they feel happening to them while they're learning. And during this time, during the COVID crisis, I'm also paying real close attention to the way that children are expressing what's happening to them. So those are the three ways that I try to engage my students in this question of being able to examine something that's really non-evident and kind of eludes empirical measures. Now think, Nick, think right now, think to the COVID crisis that we're in right now. Think about it. The very first descriptions of the disease were anecdotal, were autobiographical, were about symptoms that were happening to people individually, singularly, and then they started to generalize after they got, a number of stories, 50, 100. This method of qualifying, the unspeakable or, the physiological or what's very difficult to name symptoms. This method of narrating them has been in time immemorial. They use it during the Spanish flu as well. And so there's something really, really important, I think, about qualifying the way the body is afflicted, whether it be by anxiety, whether it be by illness, whether it be by, the wonder of engaging in the ocean, whatever it is. It's really important, I think. The narrative, the autobiographical, the literary is really an important moment in the construction of knowledge.
Well, I'd add to that I think this current moment also is highlighted, not that it hasn't been highlighted before, but that now more than ever, individuals are representing their lives autobiographically, whether that's through images on Instagram or through different stories on
TikTok.
Yeah. Facebook. it's just amazing to see how different people are expressing their lives autobiographically, through these different social media platforms. But still, I find that the invitation to have conversations about one's lives within that, as soon as you enter the doors to a university or a school, tend to be left at the door. That's not to say that's the case for everyone. And perhaps with the shift of kids now being at home in their homes and teachers reaching out, there's more attention for some teachers to learn more about the lives of the students that are at home. And that's not to say that the teachers haven't always wanted to learn about the lives of the students in their classroom, but maybe learning about the different aspects that normally wouldn't enter the doors of a school. And I think the same in terms of educational administration, learning more about the different dynamics of students' lived experiences that they would not necessarily learn about because there was no need to talk about it prior to the pandemic. So that I do see that shift.
Well, Nick, I think it's I think it's a little bit more than just, and this is why, I've been told even, by mentors and other people about my own academic writing, like, oh, Parnaim, do you really want to talk about yourself, or do you really want to be so personal, or is that really scholarly, like these kinds of, passive remarks that we're so used to in the university. Anyways, And to me, I'm not writing anything personal, because if it was really, truly personal, you wouldn't be able to write it, firstly. Secondly, because, you know, most of what happens to you is unspeakable. Secondly, I'm trying to say that it's not, you just don't want to learn about your students, that their students' autobiographical stuff is the grounds of their learning. It does enter into the classroom every day. Their autobiography accompanies you wherever you go. You can't just ignore it. It's like ignoring the world, right? So there's another way that academics defend against knowledge, which is like many of our colleagues probably right now have retreated into their offices and, you know, busily being productive. When the world is falling apart around us, you cannot ignore the self and you cannot ignore the world in learning. Both of those things ground learning. They ground political action. They ground social relations. And so it's not, for me, it's not a learning about. It's fundamentally, the foundation of education is the self-other relation for me. It's just foundational. And everything else happens after that.
I love how you knock on the desk while you're saying your voice.
Well, you know me, I'm a little emphatic. Yeah. I'm trying to soften that.
Yeah, and I'm with you on that in terms of thinking of course schools and that's the myth is that once you walk through the door your lived experience and who you are autobiographically stop at the door. And perhaps not that they stop at the door, but opportunities to kind of, as you said, to work through them. And that whether that's, I try to think of my three sons and whether or not they're being asked to think through their own lived experiences or, you know, and whether or not they want to work on that or articulate it within the context of the classroom is a different story. And it seems to me that's the kind of work that you're asking, that you ask your teacher candidates or grad students to do. And it's the same work that I ask teacher candidates and grad students to do. In what ways do you work with them in terms of supporting their revolts to what you're asking them to do in your classroom?
I have to say I've been very lucky in a way that my modes of pedagogy do, and I do think it's because I make an appeal to students. I feel that my job as a teacher is to persuade them. It's to actually start from the position that my students are going to reject what I'm going to say, just like my children do all the time. And so that's my starting point, is that it comes out of my academic training too, because, you know, being a woman of color in the academy, it's like it's hard for people to take me seriously, I think. And so I've always started from the point of, I'm going to have to persuade others to hear me. I'm going to have to find them a compelling way to make the argument. And literature's really helped me with that. I mean, I feel like Coetzee is trying to deliver some messages that are very, very hard for people to hear. You know, that human beings aren't loving, that they actually, you know, have done terrible things to each other, and that a lot of the knowledge that we revere has given us the justification to do so. I mean, I think that's, you know, what he's trying to say in his novels in a nutshell, is that these beautiful theories that we hold up are used like technicians and used, you know, and brutalized while we're using them, have done so much damage to others because we haven't thought about the logics behind, you know, whiteness, for an example, that was a pretty big example in his work, the logics of white mythology that continue to run the world, you know, we don't think about it. And so I think that the way that I think about my students' disagreements with me or revolts against my pedagogy that's the starting point for teaching. The starting point is, who are you to think that someone else is going to believe what you're saying? I mean, that's the starting point for me. What makes you so special? Because you're the teacher. And I actually think that's something that all experts should hold, even doctors. Who the hell do you think you are that you could think that you could cure people actually of diseases that we, you know, that we're still 200 years later have no closer to? And, you know, this is where the humility and the humiliation comes in, is that you have to, I think if you are anybody that's helping someone else in the helping profession, as, you know, medical doctors and teachers and politicians are, you have to come in with a standpoint that even if you do think you know better, you probably will find out you don't. And I've, you know, found out that for my students many, many times. I've been surprised many, many times. I'm surprised regularly, you know, every day. Even when I know a person, I'm continually surprised by the ways in which people respond, the ways that I respond. And I think that kind of openness and curiosity is, you know, forms the grounds for the kind of critical reflexive mode. And it takes a long time, Nick, as you know, too. It takes a long time to learn how to become a teacher. And I feel like the doctors out there are learning that it takes a long time to become a doctor. It takes a long time to become a parent. You know, the failure, the ethics of failure is so important, and the ethics of humility is so important in the caregiving professions. You know, it's not fun to care for someone else. You know, it requires practice. It requires thinking. It requires a moral orientation. It requires diligence, discipline, all these things that are fallen out of fashion. So, yeah, I think that I'm ready for the revolt. I'm ready for the revolution, Nick.
I think that the one of the exciting things for me about our profession is the possibility, the continual possibility of being surprised and learning. I say learning, but
you are exemplary academic for curiosity, surprise, and affirmation. I mean, I've learned a lot from your orientation. Even when I know that you're maybe not really surprised, you're still always seeming like you are. It's just, I've learned a lot from your orientation, Nick. I wanted to say that.
I am, though, and I think that's the what comes through in your piece, especially your new book, is it's provoked me to go now, and I'm like, I need to go read more of Coetzee's work. But also just the rich interconnections that you make to, like, I can really, when I'm reading your work, I can really see your love for literature and poetry. And, you know, I know I don't know if it's recently, but in the other piece that you sent me, Engaging Text Today, or How to Read a Crickler Poem, you start by saying that you've just recently, I don't know if it's recent or you've joined the editorial team for the Journal of Curriculum Theorizing. And I'm just wondering, how are you imagining that section of the journal? And again, I thoroughly enjoyed reading it, and the connections that you're able to make historically to the field of curriculum studies, but then also to literature and the different concepts that you're thinking through in your introduction. So just wondering, potential grad students who are thinking about submitting pieces, or your fellow colleagues, how are you envisioning the work that you're doing as editor for that section, Engaging Text?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Nick, for reading the piece. I really appreciate it. I think that I've been moving towards this kind of writing for across my career. And I consider it pedagogical writing, which is different than a scholarly text for me. I'm thinking about the ways in which I'm trying to compel others to read. I mean, in this moment, before COVID, reading seemed to be just like almost, you know, gasping for air. I wrote this piece 6 months ago, so I wanted just to show you that I've been thinking about not this crisis. I couldn't have even imagined it, really. Illness is like is probably for me existentially. Everyone's afraid. Some people are afraid of monsters. Some people are afraid of war. I'm afraid of getting sick. You know, this is like one of the worst things that could have ever happened to me in terms of a disaster, a catastrophe. But I wrote this six months ago because I already felt like we were in a crisis because of the anti-intellectual environment, the fascist environment that was rising up all around the world with these strong men, you know, and I do feel that whiteness is breathing its last, you know, terrible gasp. When rulers fall down, when empires fall, when bullies fall, Nick, they take down everybody with them. You know, they take everything down with them, everything that was built, because they can't have it. No one can. So I felt like we were in that kind of moment. And so I wrote this piece because just like whenever I've been in a crisis, I have always turned to others. I've always turned to the thinking and the thought of others. And some of these are literary texts, but to me, some of them are also scholarly thinking texts, idea texts is what I'm going to call them now. And I think I'm an idealist. I think that I hold strongly to ideas and thinking and education and literature as the way out because it provides us a vocabulary. It gives us a window into maybe a better world, another world, the world we want. Those are the reasons that I wrote the piece, to solicit from other people their ideas on what they're reading, what they're thinking about, how they're thinking about the ideas that they're studying, what can they bring to the world, how can we set about theory into the world, how can we act in the world with as informed subjects, as subjects who've thought about it carefully. And so the call really is like, how are you thinking about the world and what are you reading? That's really what I'm asking. And, you know, it would be something like I would ask my students or colleagues on a panel. I want to replicate academic study in the way, in its true and most meaningful sense, which is like an opening to someone else to think with you. And so that I think it could take any kind of form in that section. I mean, that section has always been my favorite for the journal, I have to say, since its inception. And I think Peter Trifonis at one time was the editor, and I really enjoyed his approach to it as well. And so so that's the one thing. And the second thing is I really think in education that we have a moment to get away from the explication of text in our theorizing, the constant explication or trying to prove we're smart. Or I don't think that's our role as educational scholars. Our role is to deliver what someone else is thinking, to make a provocation like you have always done at the conferences, to lift up somebody else's work, to engage in an idea that isn't maybe as well thought out as it could be, but has a lot of potential. So I want to take that kind of orientation to my scholarly work now. I want to write for the public. You know, my colleagues are all smart. They don't actually really need to hear from me. The others do, right? So yeah. You know, I'm in my midlife, Nicholas. I'm in my midlife. I can do what I want.
You
now.
Do what you want.
Yeah.
What is your want? Is that that's the midlife? That's the midlife hit midlife.
Once you hit midlife, you've come into yourself, and you don't have to genuflect, and you don't have to seek out patronage, and you can actually say something. I'm really tired of the other.
I feel my three boys have come into their own. They really let me know what they think all the time.
Right. You're doing your job as a parent.
Yeah. I really like the way in which you situated the concept of curriculum in this piece. And you say curriculum is then a demand and plea for the living in our struggle for memory, for every violently lost, gentle, or loving soul in their memory, which came before us and continued to make our way. And I, you know, to think about curriculum in that way is a kind of a trace, a memory trace of those that have come before us and what our relationship might be to them, as opposed to thinking about it as knowledge per se. And you know, and I guess then that would be my question is memory knowledge or knowledge memory. I don't know. Maybe that's for another time to discuss. But, you know, the other big concept narrative theme that you take up in your work and the work of others, you know, when we're talking about memory and loss is grief. And we're not all experiencing, for example, in our household, our interconnections with immediate family that we've been fortunate enough that everyone's been able to keep safe or relatively safe. But I know that's not the case for everyone in that others have lost someone and are grieving. And I'm wondering what it's like for you. And I'm thinking in our household, you know, you look at the daily reports in the media and how many lives are lost, but I don't necessarily get a sense yet that there's been a collective sense of being able to grieve in terms of COVID-19, and especially in terms of what's recently taken place in Canada and out in Nova Scotia and the loss of lives of there, as having to time or necessary space during the current context to be able to grieve the loss or lives of others. So just wondering, you know, how you're thinking about your work in relation to scholarship.
Yeah, Nick, I mean, you're really making me think about the way that, and I do think of grief psychoanalytically. So the when I use the word grief, I'm thinking about it both as a social construct, but also as the psychical one, the same way that I do with reparation. And sometimes they collapse. I got to get better at being more precise about when I'm, how I'm using a term and when. But what we are experiencing now is this kind of overwhelming grief that I would liken it to the way that as a society, and I would liken it to the way that the infant comes into the world, you know, helpless, vulnerable, not knowing its other, dependent, completely dependent. I would liken it to that kind of first psychical state of the human being, which is like this overwhelming, you know, Freud called it anxiety, but I think it's grief. And I come through it through Klein, and it seems to have more of a grief-stricken tone than the more depressed kind of version that Freud gives us. But if we think of a society that's completely overwhelmed by grief right now, that there's actually no way to even articulate what this is that we're feeling. You know, people use words like trauma, but it's too soon really to make sense of it. It's, and like anyone who's been hit by a catastrophe, we can just sit with each other right now. Be with each other, whether it's virtual platforms like this on the phone. Both Paul and I have elderly parents in late stage of disease. You know, we're constantly thinking about our parents and how vulnerable they are right now. So there's this kind of personal grief that each of us feels that is different and unthinkable. I mean, I can't even imagine what it would be like to lose someone right now and not be able to properly bury your dead and all of those things. I imagine that what I theorize is that out of grief, knowledge is produced. And I'm interested to see what kind of knowledge is going to be produced. Right now, all we can see is manifestations of it, different kinds of acting out, you know, the protesting against the social isolation. I'm sure there's been 100 meltdowns in people's homes with each other, and you know, lots of tension and within the family, and lots of joy too. These are all manifestations, I think, of sorrow and of disappointment, of shock. But what will we make of it? This is what I'm always thinking. What are we going to make of it? What narrative are we going to tell? I mean, this was Cameron McCarthy's question after 9/11. Are we going to tell the narrative about an enemy, or are we going to tell a story about how incredibly dependent we are on each other? What kind of story are we going to tell? And I, you know, people think of Hannah Arendt used worldliness. Bill Piner used Courier, but I think the quality of humanness is really just we're a long story. This is a long story that we get to tell and retell and revise, repair, restore this story. We get to tell it. And I'm not sure what's going to happen after COVID-19, but I really do not want to go back to the world that was. That it was a mean, lean, careerist, no time for your kids world. I don't want to go back to that, Nick. I want a world where people have universal access to healthcare, to income, to opportunity, to joy. And maybe people will think that's idealistic, but I think we should meet the basic needs of people, the basic needs. Doesn't mean we're not going to have strife and conflict and rivalry and meanness. It just means that we can have it all. We can start from this, the same place, because we all do start from the same place, which is from the place of grief. And so while we're submerged in it, we might not be able to think about it, but I'm thinking about it. I'm thinking about it because I'm a teacher. I'm thinking about the story I'm going to tell to my students when I see them, the story I'm already starting to compose. I don't think we can, I think Toni Morrison said this, I don't think we can just sink into despair. I think this is the time that we have to get up, and we're the adults, we're Generation X. We're caught between the old and, the past and the future. So we're the adults of the society, and this is our chance. We have to do something.
Aparna, I just wanted to thank you for taking the time to share more about your work today. And it's been a pleasure having you on Fukin Conversation. We barely got into a lot of the concepts that you put forth in your work. And I know we're going to need a couple more sessions to discuss those, and I'd really love to do that. But more importantly, would love to touch base with you again on the podcast to talk about the story that you'll be sharing in 6 months from now, whether that's in relation to pathos or humiliation or grief, or even in terms of how you're thinking about the work of pedagogy in relation to the stories your students share in your classroom. So thank you again for taking the time this morning to talk to me.
Thank you, Nick. I really appreciate the opportunity, and I always enjoy talking to you. And yeah, let's keep the conversation going. I really would love that.